Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply that proves that award season really is a year-round event. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with Vanity Fair's film critic Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And joining us this week, as Mike is away, Vanity Fair senior staff writer Joanna Robinson.
Hello.
So this week we've drafted Joanna to talk about two subjects very close to her heart. I actually can't imagine two better topics to have Joanna to chime in on. We're going to start with Roadies, which is Cameron Crowe's new Showtime series. He won an Oscar for the screenplay for Almost Famous, and he's basically been fighting an uphill battle ever since, with his movies that were either perplexing like Vanilla Sky or totally hated like Aloha. And it seems like television might be his chance for a comeback, and we're going to talk about whether or not that's actually going to happen. And then from there, we'll check in one last time on the ongoing season of Game of Thrones, which will air its finale on Sunday and just aired its most ambitious episode of the season, maybe ever, with Battle of the Bastards. It's been visually dazzling, that episode being no exception. But Joanna, you had a really interesting piece on Sunday talking about the dramatic stakes of this season, and we'll talk about whether or not it's actually as daring as it used to be. But first, the week in Oscar news, which, as it sometimes is also the week in blockbuster news. Finding Dory made a ton of money, you guys. I haven't seen it. Joanna, I know you saw it. Richard, did you?
No, I actually still shamefully haven't seen Finding Nemo. I think I confessed on the podcast this week. So I'm really behind on this whole cinematic universe, let's say.
Oh, well, the ocean is full of depths and probably many more sequels where that came from.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not, that said though, I'm not surprised that it did as well as it did. It was the highest opening animated film ever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was 13 years late, you know, after the fact, after Nemo came out. That's a beloved property, and Ellen is still beloved, and mm-hmm. everything about it just worked. And I think that the kid movie season has sort of been at a lull, so this really, because I think everyone cleared the decks for this movie, and
it's basically Zootopia off. Which was 3 months ago at this point, and
right,
this,
right, yeah. Zootopia, which was also a huge hit, mm-hmm. not quite this big, but yeah, those, you know, that Pixar, you know, after a kind of a bumpy end to last year.
Yeah, Good Dinosaur was rough for them.
This is really good news for them. Although I guess it does kind of concern me a little bit in that, you know, obviously the Toy Story sequels are fantastic. And, you know, so I'm not saying that a Pixar sequel is necessarily a bad thing. But you look at something like Cars, which is really just exists to make merchandise. And, you know, it's kind of the cash in. They're not never as good as other Pixar kind of standalone titles, like Inside Out, for example.
Yeah.
So, as good as I hear Finding Dory is, you know, you worry a little bit about Pixar falling trapped to the same kind of sequelitis that's plagued, you know, Disney and other companies.
Joanna, you saw the movie. Do you feel like it does it have that sequel problem, or does it kind of stand on its own?
No, I mean, it's basically the exact same movie as Finding Nemo. I liked it. I didn't like it as much as Finding Nemo, maybe because I'm 13 years older.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much that 13-year gap was like perfectly timed to get the people who, you know, it mattered so much to them when they were younger, and maybe they have kids now, or
oh my god,
whatever. I don't know how young people are having kids these days, but anyway, point being,
well, yeah, it's not like you were a kid when Finding Nemo came out either. Like you didn't grow up clutching a stuffed dory.
No, I was in college when it came out,
yeah.
but I remember weeping openly in the theater in college.
Yeah,
and I did not do that for Finding Dory. I thought it was very cute, and some really funny, clever stuff. I have a like unnatural fear of octopuses. Mm-hmm. So
I think a rational fear, honestly.
the Ed O'Neill character was terrifying to me. But for me, actually, what I really loved more than Finding Dory was the short Piper that was in front of it. I haven't liked a Pixar short, I don't know, since Presto, I think it was, which was several years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is the best one they've had in a long time. It's a really charming, silent story about a bird on the California shore, and digitally, technologically, like very amazing. And Pixar gets nominated a lot for a short animated film, but they don't win a lot. So I actually think they could win both a feature and animated short this year.
Yeah, and you wrote a piece about Piper on VF.com that people should read if they're interested on how that happened, and kind of pointed out that it makes the animated short category, which we have stressed over on this podcast in the past, a little bit easier because, you know, last year Pixar short was Lava, which everyone hated and wasn't even nominated. So it's a lot easier this time around. Richard, do you feel like Finding Dory is like a, you know, are you going to settle your animated feature ballot now?
No, I mean, I think that there are some other upcoming films like in the animated world that could and probably likely will pose a threat to even as beloved as it is, a kind of like sequel. I think that probably the biggest one on my radar is Moana, or how do you
pronounce it? Moana.
I think, yeah. It's a Disney set in the South Pacific, I believe. Kind of, it's the next kind of, they're calling it princess movie. It's a musical. You know, from what everything, they just released a trailer recently on TV, right?
During the Tonys.
Which is perfect. Lin-Manuel Miranda is a voice in it. You know, I think that it looks gorgeous, and you know, given what a sensation Frozen was and still is, I think that all eyes are sort of on that to see if Disney can continue this revitalization of the princess movies that hasn't really happened, you know, since the early late 80s with Little Mermaid when they brought it back kind of reinvented it. I think in some ways that's going to get more attention than Dory, you despite this enormous box office.
For me, I'm really looking forward to Kubo and the Two Strings, which is a Laika film. I think Laika does, who did Box Trolls, like I think they do amazing,
beautiful,
amazing animation work. There it has been some pre-pushback about the voice cast, which includes at least Matthew McConaughey. It's at least Asian inspired story, and the voice cast is pretty much predominantly white. So, given the larger conversation we're having about Asian actors and their representation in film, should this extend to voice acting? Probably. So I don't know if that film is just going to be embattled in that kind of controversy, but
That'll be another place where Moana kind of pushes the conversation forward, because it's got Dwayne Johnson, who's of many different heritage, but I think Pacific Islanders in there, and a newcomer as the main voice. So
right, which was sort of, I mean, Disney has, I think, made a real conscious effort towards that, like with the Jungle Book, mm-hmm. trying to do like a non-white casting for these films that push into different cultures, even in the voice realm.
Yeah, so. And Pixar movies, as beloved as they are generally very white and voiced by a lot of white people, like Finding Dory. So that could be, you know, as the Oscars so white conversation really never ends and continues in the next season, that'll be something that'll affect even the animated race, it seems like.
Another animated movie I just wanted to draw quick attention to, just because I have a personal connection with it, is Trolls.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. When I was in Cannes with our own Julie Miller, we went to a Trolls event. That there is a post on VF.com all about this Trolls event.
A must read, I would say.
It was the must go to event at Cannes. The movie looks crazy. It's a musical with using extant pop songs, although some new stuff also that Justin Timberlake wrote. With Anna Kendrick and Justin Timberlake as the lead voices. It's based on the toys. We saw like, I don't know, 15 minutes worth of clips from it, from a footage of it. It looks insane. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I will eagerly be seeing Trolls just to see what the end product of this bizarre and rather lavish Cannes presentation is.
Well, and the Justin Timberlake song for that movie is currently number 2 on the Billboard charts. So this is the world that we are living in.
Shows how much I know about music. I have no idea.
We're already in the Trolls world.
Okay, and we're just living in it. Yeah.
Yeah, just get used to it now.
I suffer from short-term memory loss.
Yes!
That's exactly what you say.
Okay. We'll pretend to be the other kids now.
Hi, Dory!
Ahoy there! Do you want to play hide and seek?
Okay.
We'll hide, and you count and come find us.
Okay, Daddy.
No, no, not Daddy. I'm the nice fish who wants to be your friend. Okay?
Okay, Daddy.
No.
I'm Heidi.
Now count to 10.
1, 2, 3, 4. I like sand. Sand is squishy.
So, Joanna, this week you have published a piece on VF.com about your visit to the set of Roadies, which is Cameron Crowe's first TV series and really ought to be a kind of a comeback for someone who is still really beloved for films like Say Anything and Almost Famous, but is coming off of last year's Aloha, which was a rough patch for anyone. Having watched him at work, Joanna, and we can talk about the quality of the show itself, which you guys have both seen, but Joanna, since you were there kind of watching this happen, like, Does Cameron Crowe think this is his comeback? Like, is that what he is really feeling this is for him?
I don't think he's considering it a comeback, but I think he considered filming Roadies a welcome escape from all the drama surrounding Aloha. And I think what he just did was sort of knuckle down and recommit to a sphere that he's very comfortable in, because as many people pointed out, this is the closest spiritual successor to Almost Famous, which is probably his most beloved film that he made, given that it's about, you know, a touring band and the roadies that go on tour with them. So I think, you know, the atmosphere on set was not at all, I don't know, depressed or fearful or anything like that. There didn't seem to be an Aloha cloud hanging over it. It seemed very optimistic, and everyone was very, very passionate about the project. I have never heard people be so passionate about their work, and I think that just has to do with this really bewitching Kool-Aid that Cameron Crowe tends to brew, that once people drink, like, they are on board. He is like that kind of benevolent leader that people like to follow, because he does, I think, write and direct very much from the heart, to mixed results for sure. But I think you can never accuse him of doing something that he isn't completely committed to. So
is that kind of what explains, like, his, you know, it's been 15 years since he's really had something kind of across the board hit. Like, is that why people keep continuing to come back to work with him? Like, he has that kind of general leadership power that makes people want to get on board?
Yeah, and just a very rare authenticity, you know, in Hollywood. Either that, or he's like the biggest snake oil salesman in the world, but he just seems to give off this very genuine quality of, I care about what I'm doing. And I think when he has an emotional vested stake in something, it's all the better. You know, like Vanilla Sky and Aloha, which I would consider the two projects that I respond the least to, I think are the furthest away from his own experience. Whereas, like, We Bought a Zoo may not be have anything to do with his life, but the things it says about being a dad, I think at least shine through in that. And so, you know, if Matt Damon wants to go play a dad for Cameron Crowe, like, I think that was a worthy, if spotty, project, mm-hmm. You know?
So, Richard, you've seen the result of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, we want to be as fair to Cameron Crowe as we can be, but I don't think, I feel like from what I've heard from you, it doesn't come together the way that we were hoping it would.
Well, to be fair, I've only seen the first three. But yeah, from what I've seen, some of Cameron Crowe's more recent problems seem to plague this show. And what I was curious about, Joanna, is if you ever got a sense, this is what I had this question watching it, like, obviously the Almost Famous experience is one that he in some version lived in his own life as a kid,
right?
As this kind of precocious rock journalist. Is that the last time that he experienced this life on the road? I mean, is he really drawing on, you know, 30, 40-year-old experience at this point? Because there is a point, there are points in the show that I feel like really connect, and I'm like, yeah, that might be actually how it's like, and then others that feel a little bit sort of inferred or guessed about the kind of contemporary experience on the road. Do you know what kind of any research he did, you know, recently for the show?
I think you're right that he is drawing a lot on the sort of spiritual experience. And that's like mostly what he talked to me about was the feeling of being a fan and being part of a roadie crew. And I think you might be right in your criticism. I know that there is a flashback episode this season that might wind up feeling more authentic to his own experience because it's set in the time that he actually, but as far as I know, there were no roadie like consultants on the show. I could be wrong about that, but I heard nothing about roadie consultants. And I agree with you, you know, I really love the show, but I really love Cameron Crowe. But even as much as I love the show, like the third episode, which centers on a rock blogger, which was based on a real life experience Cameron Crowe had with a Led Zeppelin film critic. But as you say, that's a transplanted from a different time experience. And so instead now it's Rainn Wilson playing a contemporary film blogger. And that episode did not land for me, mostly because the comedy of Rainn Wilson rarely lands for me. But some of the other moments in the episode, some of the musical performances, and most of all, watching these characters watch these musical performances, I think this is, as are most of the films, Cameron's love letter to music in general, and the transportive like experience of listening to a beautiful piece of music, and whether it's Lindsay Buckingham or Rainn Wilson or someone else playing, like, it almost doesn't matter if I like the music. Watching these people get transported by the music is a very visceral element of the show, I think.
Yeah, and he's always been good at mood. I mean, even in Aloha, there are moments that you're like, oh, I really feel something, and I don't really know what I'm feeling, but I feel...
I don't even like this movie.
You know, I feel something sort of wistful and something, and there are definitely plenty of moments like that in the show. I mean, I think that my bias might be one of, you know, just sort of, I don't know the last time I went to a concert. Like, I'm just, I'm live music is not a part of my life in any real way, unless you count musical theater, but that's, I don't. This, it's a very different experience.
That's Smash,
yeah,
Richard.
Right, right. Oh, yeah. Which, you know, we can talk, let's do an episode about Smash. But, you know, but I can still at least connect to that sense of kind of, well, communion with other people and with, you know, a piece of art that you really like. And I think that he's always been good at capturing that. And I also think that, you know, a lot of credit should go to the kind of quirky but interesting cast he's assembled, which includes Luke Wilson, Carla Gugino, Imogen Poots, Akeisha Castle Hughes, and you know it's a really odd assemblage of people from.
Rafe, I really love Rafe Spall in this.
Oh yes,
too.
Rafe Spall,
oh,
who
man,
plays
I love
the
Rafe
kind
Spall
of company man. Yeah, he kind of comes in to like to shake things up, and weirdly has a kind of strange romantic tension with Imogen Poots, and there's something a little off about that to me. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's definitely like I was really looking forward to the show, and I will continue to watch it. It just, I think that Cameron Crowe maybe needs to sort of stop trying as hard as he is to find his voice again and just kind of like be a little more natural about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that like the more sort of fluid Altman-esque moments of this show are the ones that work the best and are what he's maybe reliant a little too heavily on plot.
I love that description, Richard. Like the almost fly on the wall conversations that you pick up between these characters as they're doing their job. And when they're not talking about plot, the central plot, it's the best. Like the Rainn Wilson episode, the third episode, everything that doesn't have to do with that, I liked. So, like, all the fringy stuff, I think, is the very best of the show. I completely agree with you. And the word I've been using in my own head to describe it is shaggy. Like, there are parts of it that work so well. And I think that's true of every single Cameron Crowe movie. Even if you don't connect to the whole thing, there are moments that just feel more authentic than almost anything else you'll see. It's just hoping that he leans more into that in a way from some of the other things. The other element I want to talk about was sort of his co-showrunner, who's Winnie Holtzman of My So-Called Life fame. And I think she's really responsible for bringing out a lot of like Imogen Poots' character, Kelly Ann, and Carla's character. Like Cameron Crowe has always been really good at the, like the male leads, accessing those male leads. But I think she brings a female voice that balances it even a little bit more.
Well, I was going to ask you guys to compare this to Vinyl, which is the other recent take on the music industry, and that one's set in the 70s, which is where Cameron Crowe's expertise comes from. But that show kind of famously did a lot of things that people didn't like, but the female characters were among them. Like, does this improve on that at least? I mean, 10 people watch Vinyl, so maybe this comparison doesn't mean anything to anybody.
Yeah, I mean, Vinyl is a lot more of an aggro kind of show, and I think that that lends itself to a male sensibility, either whether it's Bobby Cannavale's or Scorsese's or Terrence Winter's, like, and you know, I think that is pretty off-putting on vinyl. This is a lot softer. I mean, it's still focused on Luke Wilson, and he's kind of like a sort of sad Lothario in a way. But yes, I think that the presence of Winnie Holzman, who we should also remember wrote the book for Wicked and is a very rich woman because of it.
Oh my God, I always forget that.
Yeah, yeah, she's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah, you know, but I think you're right, Joanna, that she that teased out, and I think that an actress like Imogen Poots, who's really been sort of cusping for a long time. This is a good kind of sustained role for her. And I think that a lot of these shows have weird, you know, bumpy first few episodes on these cable shows. And I think that in the Netflix model where they give you the whole season, I kind of wish that Showtime had given us the whole critics, you know, the whole season of Roadies to watch, because, you know, there is something there, especially in you know, Poots' character and a couple other people. And it's like, oh, I want to see more of that before I kind of issue any, you know, declarative statement about it.
And I know that, like being on the set, they all told me that, you know, they were working on, I don't know, episode 6 or something at the time, 7 maybe, of a 10 episode season. And I know that they had all talked about how their characters had morphed, or how certain performers had been expanded because of the way that Cameron had responded to their performance. So I know that it is very much a show that's changing, that's being written not on the fly, but very close to. I don't know if shows are usually written as close to filming dates as Roadies is. So I think it's one that's very much responding to that kind of ebb and flow. And I agree with you. I really want it to get a second season, because I think in the second season, that is where it's going to like either find its voice completely or not. And I'd really want it to get there. So, and Showtime's usually pretty good at least investing in a show for 2 years.
Yeah, you're making me think of The Leftovers, which from all accounts like turned into a completely different, really great show in its second season.
That's right.
Right.
There's been a lot of stories like that in recent years about shows that are given time to find their voice, which is one of the benefits of this peak TV.
I think also in a show like Roadies could be sort of almost anthologized, in that like next season it could be a different tour for a different artist, and that could bring in a whole new host of storylines. And, you know, it has potential there. It's a good concept on paper.
So this is the True Detective season 2 model, which is the less promising version of
Well, as Richard pointed out, the band is not really, like, Staten House, which is the fictional band, is not really a key part. They're almost, you only meet, like, one performer in the band. So I think that you could have a different band, or more to the point, vinyl is about sort of like the flashy big elements of the music industry, and Roadies is about like the kids with electrical tape on their belts. You know what I mean? Like it's a different side of the whole thing.
One last question for both of you. I mean, we've watched so many people go from the film industry to TV. Like, it started with actresses like Glenn Close. Now it's Martin Scorsese and Cameron Crowe. Like, does this feel... like, as we constantly talk about blockbuster season, we talked about this last week, like, does this feel like the model that all of our best writer-directors are going to be doing eventually? Like, is Cameron Crowe just one of the first two, and then in 5 years, like, everyone who's ever won an Oscar for screenplay is going to have a TV show?
I think it's something a lot of them are going to try, and I think that we'll see how much success, you know, depends. I think it's a very, very different mode of storytelling, and I mean, obviously, that's not a revolutionary thing to say. I mean, that's known. But I think that some filmmakers and actors even flourish with, you know, 10 hours to tell a story versus 2. But we'll see. I mean, I think that Crowe in particular has sort of been telling some version of the same story for the last 25 years in some ways, or at least existing in the same world. So I think that television could work well for him. But and I think you're right, Katie, that it is a big deal that someone as sort of auteuristic and prolific as he is, has kind of decided to dip his toe into TV, and I think that will only encourage more. I don't know who will be next. Well, Nicole Holofcener is who's directed a lot of television, but she's now creating
a
show.
She's such a perfect fit for a show, too.
You know, so it's exciting that, you know, that certain filmmakers. That said, I don't think I really want to see another James Cameron show. I mean, Dark Angel was enough, right?
That's probably true.
Something is in the air.
When I look to leave her, I always stagger back again.
There are so many secrets about this band and this crew.
But the music is good. And you meet some great people.
So the end of another season of Game of Thrones is almost upon us, and we don't know how it's all going to wrap up, though we all have some ideas of where things are going to go in the finale. It seemed like a good time to check in and see just how the season has been thus far. Joanna, you have been writing about it extensively at VF the whole season, as usual, and have been an essential resource for all of us. And on Sunday, after an episode that, you know, everyone was kind of seeing as huge and epic and big and, you know, it was bloody and arrows and horses and everything, but pointed out that the stakes weren't actually nearly as high as they were as we were being led to believe. And that seems to be a problem for you for the season as a whole. And I just want to give you a chance to kind of lay out your argument for why, you know, Game of Thrones might not be as daring or as adventurous as it used to be.
I mean, I would say that the body count is very high this season, but one of the most cleverest tricks that Game of Thrones has used this season to make us think that a lot of beloved characters are dying is bringing back old characters for like one episode
and then killing
or bringing
them.
Ian McShane for an episode and then killing them. And so you're like, oh no, OSHA. Oh, but I haven't seen you in 2 years and I barely remembered your name maybe. Or Rickon, who literally did not have a line of dialogue in this season.
So true. I totally didn't realize he never spoke.
And was gone for 2 years and was never really that like impactful to begin with. Like Stark died in this episode, but like did it really matter that much? And I don't know, just the fact that, you know, I don't want to get like flippant about it, but like the fact that you have a huge battle episode which they've touted all year as their biggest, most ambitious thing yet, the fact that you have that and you have all these heroes go into battle, Davos and Tormund and Jon and Sansa, et cetera, and none of them die, despite the fact that at one point they're like almost literally buried by their enemies who are winning, and all of them emerge unscathed. To me, that feels like false peril, false stakes. And also that battle, the way it emerged was John makes an idiotic mistake and then gets saved by a deus ex machina. Like that to me is, I don't know, kind of the least interesting way you could tell that battle. So point being, the entire season of Game of Thrones, where Game of Thrones is once so famous for very ruthlessly killing off main characters, this whole season has been kind of, with the exception of Hodor, I will give Hodor some props, but still, Hodor's not like a fully fleshed character, right?
But his death was very impactful when they
showed it. It was. I loved that episode. I thought it was the best episode. His death mattered, but it's still like, I mean, it's still like the death of a mascot more than it is the death of a person that we know intimately. And there's still one episode to go, so I could very well be eating my words.
They could kill off half the cast on Sunday.
They may well, but I just think that there are certain core characters who you could all rattle off right now who are too safe in a world that once felt very unsafe. I mean, and a lot of that stems from the fact that the season starts with undoing the big death at the end of last season.
Which
you know?
Is Jon Snow.
So it's, right, Jon Snow. So it's like, you know, Jon Snow can't die. Can Arya die? Can Tyrion die? Can Daenerys die? Are all these people actually quite safe? And the unsafe world that we thought Game of Thrones was, where a Robb Stark, a Catelyn Stark, a Ned Stark could all die, just feels a lot safer now to me.
Yeah, I think also, like, you know, the show, its success almost seems to have done it in a little bit, because I mean I think I still like the show, I guess, but like, you know, when you have Ned Stark dying in season one and you have the Red Wedding and you have these kind of iconic main character deaths that kind of define the show, I think the show and in some ways its fans get addicted to that shocking death. But the problem is the show is sort of running low on compelling main characters. Mm-hmm. And so they know the hesitation is like, well, we can't kill Sansa or Tyrion or Daenerys or Jon because they're kind of all we have left. And so they just kind of, they bring in, you know, either tertiary characters from the past and then just to unceremoniously murder them in an episode, or they, you know, introduce new ones and then kill them within their first episode. And I think that like, it's a kind of cheaper way of doing it. And I think also with the the older characters like Osha and Rickon in particular, I mean, both, you know, they just felt really cruel and unnecessary. And I think that, you know, as someone who read all the books and those two characters were always interesting to me in terms of their absence, you know, you always wondered where Rickon was, and there were some hints about where his whereabouts at the end of the fifth and the last published book. And then to have him come back, and all that happens is he's killed by a character who has been established many, many, many times over as being bad.
Well, Ramsay is his own kind of separate problem.
Yeah,
from all the
but then those two problems kind of dovetailed in this way that really bothered me. And I think then that gratuitous extra shot of the arrows hitting the kid's dead body, it was just like, oh, for God's sakes, we get it. And then Osha began,
like, we are, yeah.
Same thing happened to Osha. Same guy killed her. You know, I just feel like they used Ramsay as this tool to sort of dispatch with loose at plot threads, but also while also trying to kind of cheaply get audience hackles up and like, oh, they killed this big character, when, as Joanna illustrated, it they're not actually that big characters.
Well, the loose plot threads thing seems like kind of what might be making this show. I feel like I've been pretty happy with the season, but the narrative stasis, I agree with you, but it's like they've got all these big pieces to set up for the end game that they're moving toward now. You know,
right.
We think that there's about 15 episodes left of the whole show between probably two more seasons. And so you see things like Jamie and the Blackfish, and you kind of know that Jamie's doomed. Like, Jamie does not have a role to play in this future that's being built, but they have to save him for a little bit later, so they kind of put him on hold for a little while, and it feels like they've run out of characters that aren't part of the end game, and then so people like Ramsay get to like run around and ruin everything in the meantime. Although I do want to say in the Battle of the Bastards defense, I think this episode was really beautiful, like the money that they spent on it and the production values and the thing, you know, there was a shot of Jon Snow kind of in the thick of the battle where, you know, horses are getting wiped out behind him and he turns around and there's a guy on a running by him with his head cut off, like all kinds of crazy things. It was really well executed. And I do think Game of Thrones continues to set a level of what television can look like that is pretty spectacular. And there's lots of people trying to copy it and no one's doing it quite as well as they are.
I completely agree. Like, I thought that the technical aspect of the Battle of the Bastards was amazing. The best they've ever done by far. And Miguel Sapochnik, who directed Hard Home last season, which also was quite good.
Great battle episode,
did this very hugely ambitious thing. There's a 12-minute video on YouTube, if you want to go watch, called Anatomy of a Scene, about how they shot it, and then you'll be even more impressed with what they did and how many horses were there and how long it was that Kit Harington was on top of Eoin Rowan, like pummeling his face and all that sort of stuff. Like, you know, the technical aspect of it is incredible, and that almost makes it, I don't know, worse to me that the emotional stakes, the character errors that I saw in this episode, like Jon not actually being a good general when he's been a good general in the past, or Sansa inexplicably withholding information just in order to engineer a dramatic deus ex machina result of the battle. All of those character missteps really undercut what I thought was a technically beautiful episode.
Shouldn't we be calling it a Littlefinger ex machina? Or is it a deus ex Littlefinger? I don't know.
I think Deus Ex Mockingbird is what the internet has landed on. So.
There you go. Perfect.
I mean, I'm always delighted to see Littlefinger. And although I noticed the thing is, like, Aidan Gillen's name was in the credits, so you kind of know that he's coming, which is,
right.
You know, although I think Joanna had already told me she thought the Knights of the Vale were going to show up at the last possible moment, so... If you ever want to have someone around who feels like a psychic, you can have Joanna tell you what's going to happen in a given episode of Game of Thrones.
Well, I mean, there is a lot to love about this season, I think. And like a lot of ways in which recently characters who have not seemed like themselves are returned to themselves. Like, I've been frustrated by Tyrion all season long, but I thought this was Peter Dinklage's best episode.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also frustrated by the waste of Jaime for the first half of the season, but ever since they sent him to Riverrun and away from Cersei, things have been a lot better. I'm pretty much over everything at King's Landing.
And well, it sounds like so is Cersei, and we're in for a conflagration.
Yeah. But I don't know. And to Richard's earlier point, it's not just that the show needs to hold on to these compelling characters that people have latched onto. It's that they're beholden to this murky plan that George R. R. Martin has, that they know the end game. They know what characters have to survive. I don't believe they necessarily know every step of the way that he intends to get them there. I don't think he knows. So they're having to move these pieces around, knowing that they have to survive, but also engineering exciting things to happen in the meantime while we winnow down the cast to the core characters and head towards what we all assume is a battle between dragons and ice zombies.
Well,
Yeah,
speaking of those ice zombies, I had a question for you, Joanna, as our resident expert. Why are people not like running around freaking out about these approaching ice zombies? Like, why are we having this war for Winterfell when really what's the main fight is coming from further north? I'm asking honestly, like, is there a narrative reason for that, or am I right to be confused?
No, I think you're partially right to be confused. I think they've tried in the last couple episodes to show how little people in the South believe in the White Walkers, because Jaime and Sam's dad both were like, those are myths. Those aren't real. So I don't think, you know, the only people who have seen them are the wildlings, Jon Snow and Ed. And I think that's,
and
you know,
Sam,
about
right?
it.
And Sam and Gilly.
And Sam and Gilly. And so, you know, they're having trouble getting people to believe in this myth. But yeah, why did Jon abandon the wall to go fight for Winterfell when he knows that there are ice zombies coming? That's a great question.
because Ramsay had to go. Someone had to get rid of him.
It's a fantastic question. So, you know, they had Rickon. That's why he went. It's sort of about him.
Oh, right.
You know, and you know, it's about him abandoning his Night Watch duty and sort of going back into the Stark family fold. But it's still, the whole ice zombie threat is a weird one, because I think there are some technical reasons why they can't cross through the wall, but it's just weird that they've been, I don't know, ambling, circling the north like, I don't know, some Sims on like some weird adventure, when you feel like they should be making a concerted attack. There's some indication that they can't cross the wall yet, and maybe they will once Bran gets south of the wall, but it is a really weird, we'll show them once a season, we swear they're coming, winter's coming eventually, yeah, threat on the show, you know.
And I had one last logistical question, and I know this is being annoying and pedantic, but okay, so with that same thing of the White Walkers kind of being like NPCs in a video game who get stuck and are just kind of in a little circle, so why has it taken Daenerys like 5 years to figure out how to get across the ocean, and it took Theon and his sister like 2 seconds to go the other way? I granted they weren't coming with an army, but you know what I mean? Like,
it's all the horses, like, I think, are the trick.
Yeah, are we finally going to see some movement on Daenerys, do you think?
I feel comfortable saying this because it's not a spoiler, because I don't know for sure. I feel like Daenerys is going to land in Westeros this Sunday.
I believe that's happening.
I mean, it needs to finally happen. I'm sick of the desert. I'm ready.
Yeah. You know, in the Battle of Meereen, I was like, why are the dragons all focusing on one ship? There's a lot of other ships out there. And then I was like, Tyrion Daenerys worked it out.
She finally knows how to control them. Like, it used to just be a fire spray that she wasn't able to control.
Yeah.
I don't know when she learned how to control them. There's no evidence in the show that she did, but now she seems to know how to, when she says Dracarys, have a footnote that's like, but just that boat, okay, guys? Because we need the rest of the fleet. So that's happening. You know, George R. R. Martin calls this problem the Meereenese knot for Meereen. He put Daenerys there and didn't know what to do with her, really. He is admitted to that by calling it the Meereenese knot. And it all ties back to the fact that he wanted to do a 5-year time jump in the story. So basically, Arya, Jon, and Bran and Daenerys would all be off training, like Daenerys learning how to rule, Arya learning how to be an assassin, Bran learning how to be a three-eyed raven, Jon learning how to be a general. And then you jump ahead in time 5 years and they would come back knowing all these great skills. And he didn't manage to make it happen. And so instead we get what are some of the most frustrating parts of the story, where you're so bored watching Arya in the House of Black and White, or you don't really want Bran to be sitting in that cave forever. They made that more interesting with flashbacks this year. But like, you know, and Daenerys is I think the most egregious example, where she winds up with a Dothraki horde that she probably could have had in the first season if they hadn't.
Well, or the second season,
well,
at least.
She had like a shaggy sort of dilapidated version of the massive army she is now, but like that they needed those dragons to grow up. I don't know. It's just a big, some of the plots are big time stalls and you can tell. And so I think you're right, Richard, that it is well past time that Daenerys get herself to Westeros.
Well, I was already excited for Sunday's episode, but the idea of Daenerys landing in Dorne or wherever she winds up on Sunday night, that would be very satisfying.
The dragons melt the wall with their fire so the White Walkers can get through, and then we're there we all are.
Yeah. Just fast forward.
My theory is that either Cersei burns up the Iron Throne with wildfire or the dragons melt it down so that very soon, the question of who sits on the Iron Throne is the last question on anyone's mind.
Which is what it should have been if anyone was paying attention to these ice zombies who were wandering around.
Exactly, yeah.
Do you like games, little man? Let's play a game. Run to your brother. The sooner you make it to him, the sooner you get to see him again. That's it. That's the game. Easy. Ready? Go.
No, you have to run, remember? Those are the rules.
Before we go, let's take a look back at the year that Cameron Crowe won that Oscar for Almost Famous for Best Original Screenplay. Richard and Joanna, looking at the other contenders, which were Billy Elliot, Aaron Brockovich, Gladiator, and You Can Count on Me, what should have won the Best Original Screenplay in 1999?
I'm going to go with You Can Count on Me, a great script by Kenneth Lonergan, who also directed the movie. It was ostensibly Mark Ruffalo's kind of star-making role, another great performance by the currently kind of missed Laura Linney.
She's in the Ninja Turtles movie, I heard.
Yeah, that's true, she is. But it's a great little movie. Came out in 2000, I believe.
Yeah.
About a brother and a sister.
I guess 99 or 2000. Wait, I guess this is 2000. I said 99. Yeah. This is 2000. Sorry.
A story about a brother and a sister. And, you know, as I have an older sister who I'm very close with, and I feel like narratives like that aren't really told that often on screen. And I liked that about it. Great performances by everybody. And just such a sharp script. We're going to get to see Lonergan do it again this fall in Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah, which you've seen.
I saw at Sundance and is quite strong. Not as strong as You Can Count on Me, which I think is really one of the best, if not just movies, one of the best independent films of its decade. So I'm firmly on
easy choice for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Joanna?
You Can Count on Me also has that incredible cello score. It's a really just a very beautiful film that if people haven't seen, they should. I am just so in the tank for Cameron Crowe that I can't even tell you. I can't even consider anything else. But I will obviously throw some love to Billy Elliot, which I think is just one of the greatest movies of all time, and another killer soundtrack. But that's not the point. The point is we're talking about screenplay. And it was one of several movies in the late 90s that had to do with like coal miners and Brastoff and Full Monty and all these sort of things. And I think Billy Elliot is the best example of all that. Obviously, Billy is not himself a miner, but that clash, that drama is in the background of this kid's personal drama. I've seen that movie a million times. It always works so well for me. I'm a little sad that it's been flattened a bit by turning into this the stage musical, which I think sort of flattens some of its sharper, quirkier edges to make it more mainstream and consumable. But I think Billy Elliot is a tremendous film. But I don't think anything matches Almost Famous for a writer at the top of their craft telling there. I think this is, I mean, I hope great things for the future of Cameron Crowe, but I don't think he's ever going to find a film that is a project that is as personal to him and his own experience. And every single great writer, I hope, finds this story and tells it that just feels true at every turn.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't take away Almost Famous's Oscar either, but I did want to stick up for Aaron Brockovich, which is an incredibly satisfying movie. It really holds up. It's a, you know, Soderbergh talking about people being on top of their game this year when he had this in Traffic. And is you know, it's got a great star performance that anchors it, but I think the story about the screenplay written by Susanna Grant really does a lot of the legwork there. So credit. This was a pretty good year. I mean, yeah. Gladiator's a really good movie too. Yeah.
And Susanna Grant also, you know, wrote a fantastic character piece that also has to deal with like hexavalent chromium and all these she actually gets the science in there in a way that's probably pretty simplified, but like it still works and the story feels credible. And so that's a tricky balancing act.
Is hexavalent chromium, is that really the term? You remember
I think I've seen that movie a lot. Yeah, I don't remember fully. But yes, you're right, Katie. It was a fantastic year for the whole lineup was great. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, the evening is over. We hope you all enjoyed yourselves, and we'll see you all again in 1974. Good evening!
Well, that does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you, as always, for listening, and rate us and review us on iTunes if you have a moment. It helps us find new listeners, and we appreciate it. You can find us all at vanityfair.com and on Twitter. I'm at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H. Joanna?
I'm at Joe Rothis.
And Richard?
Rylaws.
This episode was produced by Sam Dingman, and thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for most meta review of the show Fringe goes to Joanna Robinson.
All the fringy stuff, I think, is the very best of the show.